Flojohn Cofer serves on the Measure U Community Advisory Committee, working to ensure effective oversight of the new 1 cent Measure U tax dollars in Sacramento. She joins me to talk about how the 15-person committee will work with residents to hear spending proposals and make spending recommendations. Next on Studio Sacramento.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
Flo, most bond issues get passed and you never hear about them again. Why do we have a committee for Measure U?
We have a committee for Measure U because people really cared about where this money was going. It was the right time for the city to start paying more attention to its budget in a way that oftentimes, it, just like you said, we don't pay much attention. In light of what happened with the Stephon Clark shooting and people really paying attention to what was happening in terms of investments in the neighborhoods in Sacramento. And so that's really why Measure U has gotten as much attention as it has.
It's interesting you mentioned the Stephon Clark shooting. And as part of the whole set of issues related to neighborhoods, their development, and who's living there and what their opportunities are. From the standpoint of the committee, what do you believe that your charge is?
Our charge, as written in the documents that created us, is for us to provide advice to City Council. So we are an advisory committee to be able to weigh in on how the Measure U money is spent. And that is a very different charge than the previous Measure U committee had, which was basically just to make sure that the Measure U money was spent as they said it was going to be spent. We actually are charged with making recommendations and formally proposing things to the council to do with the Measure U money.
That is really interesting. Interesting. How are you all going to make recommendations? Where are you going to get that information from?
We are going to solicit it from the community. And so that's one of the great things about the way that our committee is working is that we have completely open meetings. And so we are going to be requesting that people send us recommendations for how to spend this money, come and testify before us and share their views on what some of the major issues are in the city. The purpose of having a committee that has 15 people on it that represents such a wide and diverse cross-section of our city is so that we're getting those perspectives in and considering them even as we're vetting projects.
Some might say that we elect council members to do that. Mm-hmm. Why do we as a community need you all?
Well, the council members have a different charge. For one, they, they often have worked their ways through the ranks in terms of, you know, the political process and being able to run for office. And so they have been, in many instances, they've been doing this work for a while. And so they have the perspective of having worked as city council members or as the mayor. And the community members are sort of living in these communities, doing some of the work that we actually need to understand in order to be able to vet projects. So I think there's a real need for people who are actively engaging in some of the work that's happening to provide those perspectives. But also, we have a charge for this particular committee that's a little different than others. One of the seats is for someone under 24, and so we have that seat. We have each of the city council members obviously having the ability to appoint someone, and then we have people who have a background in public health or youth services or business and economic development who are on the committee to provide that particular expertise.
Yeah, give us a sense of who else is serving on this committee.
Sure. So our committee is 15 people, and we have a really wide, and as I said, diverse array of Sacramentans on the committee. We have everyone from Amanda Blackwood, who is over the Metro Chamber. We have Marjorie
Dickinson. First female CEO.
Yes, first female CEO of the Metro Chamber. We have Alice Perez, who's with AT&T and is representing part of the business community. We have Stevante Clark, the brother of Stephon Clark, representing District 8. We have Kim Williams, who's with the Black Child Legacy Campaign. We have Imani Lucas, who is with Health Education Council. We also have Debbie Odo Kent, who is with the Health Education Council as well. We have Dana Cavell, who is with Sacramento State.
You can stop there. That is a extremely diverse committee, but diverse from the standpoint of backgrounds. But from observing the history of Sacramento and similar types of committees, in the past. This does not look like business as usual, because frankly, it would all be, you know, old business community folks.
And developers.
And developers and folks like that. This is very different.
Yes.
What does that say about the priorities that you all have collectively in terms of how you're going to go about your job?
Well, I think what it says is that we are now at a place as a city to really reconsider some of the things that were foregone conclusions for a long time.
Like what?
Like the idea of how we spend our budget every year, right? I mean, most cities, and Sacramento is not exceptional in this, spend most of their money on public safety defined as police and fire. That's always been the way we've spent our money, and we haven't really thought much about it.
What's wrong with that? Some would say that the neighborhoods, and particularly the underserved communities, have a greater need for police and fire than anyone else.
They have a greater need for public safety investments, certainly. But defining that simply as police and fire does the same thing that we used to do to medicine, right? Our medical system was largely defined as being able to get care when you need it, right? Emergency management is the pinnacle of the U.S. healthcare system, not prevention. But we started recognizing that you can't manage your way out of a lot of the issues that we're facing in health, that what we needed to do was take a step upstream and work on these issues before they became so damaging that you needed quadruple bypass surgery or other things like that. Because it's just not a solvent system when you're constantly paying to repair things instead of thinking about how we can make sure they don't or they're not broken in the first place. So it's sort of like, you know, owning a home, right? Do you defer maintenance until you have to fix everything, or do you, on an ongoing basis, make little investments so that nothing ever breaks?
So are our neighborhoods and the residents that live there, for some of them, are they the victims of deferred maintenance?
In many ways, yes.
Tell us how that manifests itself.
That manifests itself in us seeing public safety as only being police and fire and not thinking about it as being, where are people going to go to access food? Where are people going to work? How are they going to get there? I mean, if you think about even some of the recent changes in SAC-RT in terms of how we provide service, a lot of that was to decrease time so that people don't have to wait an hour for the next bus, because that has a big impact on whether or not you can get to work every day and you can access the other services throughout the rest of the city. When we think about, you know, the investments we've made in the literal infrastructure in terms of where have we built parks, where have we decided to invest in community centers, what have we done to make sure that each community has something? How often do we clean the streets? How often do we make sure that the community is well lit? What are the other investments we're making that go beyond just having somebody available when someone calls 911? Because I see every 911 call as an opportunity to look and see what could have prevented that call in the first place. And there are a lot of opportunities where we could have prevented. There are going to be some where we're always going to need some amount of emergency services. But I don't think a city is healthy if half of its budget is spent on reactionary services related to public health and not on those major preventive investments that make it so that we live healthy lives in the first place.
But from a financial standpoint, there are tremendous city employment and in particular police and fire obligations, not just salaries, but pensions, health care, and the like.
Yes.
Those are obligations that a bargain was made. Your issues, as you describe them, sound compelling, but should they crowd out pre-existing obligations to people who have made a bargain with the city
that need to
be honored?
Not at all. We have to honor our pension obligations. We would be unethical if we didn't. When you make a promise to someone, you should honor that promise. So we are going to have to find a way to make sure that we pay those. But what we don't have to do is continue to make the same mistake moving forward in terms of the bulk of our budget being spent on these services in this way without really looking to see, is this what we need? And the example that I can think of most is that a lot of the calls that police, for example, field are calls related to nuisances and related to mental health. And so they are not equipped to be able to provide a long-term solution for those. So we call, we do a quick little, you know, something to be able to appease the person who called for a little while, but that problem is still there. The underlying issue is not resolved. And so if we don't make some investment in resolving the underlying issue, we just have this revolving sort of, you know, back and forth of we call the police, they come out, they do nothing long term. We call the police, they come out, do nothing long term. And we're going to continue to sink money into that.
Well, let's talk about the money. Give us the basic structure of Measure U, where it came from, and how the recent passage is different than what was already in place.
Sure. So now a decade ago, voters in Sacramento voted to approve Measure U as a half-cent sales and use tax. And that was scheduled to expire in the spring at the end of March of 2019. And so in 2018, the mayor and council decided to propose renewing that Measure U half-cent tax, but making it a one-cent permanent sales tax. And so now that tax will not expire. It is in effect in perpetuity until the voters come along and decide to repeal it. So that is the major difference, is that the one was set to sunset, this one does not, and now it's 1 cent. And the thing I think a lot of people don't recognize about it is it's not just a sales tax, it's also a use tax, which means that, for example, there are far fewer car dealerships within the city of Sacramento. But the use tax requires that if you buy your car in Roseville or in Folsom or in one of the surrounding areas that's not part of the city, you still pay that Measure U use tax to the city.
And how much money is this going to generate?
About $100 million a year. The half-cent Measure U tax brought in about $50 million a year, so we are slated to bring in $100.
Now, you know the cynics believe that the minute that this money starts to pour in, that the power structure, whether it's labor unions, including police and fire, real estate developers, you know, big business, whatever, is going to snatch all of that away and use it for their own purposes. Do you all have any power to make a difference?
Well, I'm going to take one step back and say, I think it's funny that you are not including me in the cynics, because I think I'm in this role in particular at the chair because I am potentially one of the cynics, and I'm trying to turn my cynicism into productivity, because it's one thing to stand on the sidelines and say,